I'd like to welcome everybody to this, which is the fourth in NEABPD's Winter Call-In Series. I'm Jim Hall. I'm Executive Vice President. And on the open line with me is this evening's guest speaker, Dr. Sherry Manning, and our President, Dr. Perry Hoffman. And before I introduce our speaker, I'd like to cover just a few details for the evening. First, all of the incoming phone lines have been muted. We want to put a premium on your listening experience. But we do want to get your feedback, and especially we'd like to have your questions, which we'll make an attempt to answer with any time that's remaining this evening. So be sure to email us now or during the presentation at neabpd@aol.com. Now, the call-in tonight is being recorded, and as with previous call-ins beginning last fall, you can listen to all past presentations on our website at borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. And I don't know of another place where people can find such a comprehensive sound and video library as we have at borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. So thinking about visuals, I've said it up to now, but I'm going to repeat again. So if you don't have a downloaded copy of the handouts prepared by Dr. Manning, write to us at neabpd@aol.com and ask for tonight's handouts. This free series of presentations is certainly a credit to the outstanding mental health professionals who have volunteered their time and wisdom. And the folks who conceived of and bring these calls to your telephone are part of the all-volunteer organization, which is NEABPD. So your donations will let us keep and expand our programs to educate and to inform. So please click on the donate button at borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. Now, for tonight's speaker, Dr. Manning, Dr. Sherry Manning, is the former president and chief CEO of behavioral tech and behavioral tech research that provides training, consultation, and dialectical behavior therapy. She also has founded the South Carolina Center for Dialectical Behavior Therapy, and I think it's now called the SC Center for DBT. It's a private outpatient intensive DBT practice that serves both adults and adolescents. And I want to say this amazing person is involved in other consulting, training activities, plus she is now the co-founder of what's called the Treatment Implementation Collaborative. That's the short for that is TICLLC, some call it TICLIC, for training and consulting mental health professionals in dialectical behavior therapy. And finally, I urge you to read her new book. It's entitled Loving Someone with Borderline Personality Disorder, How to Keep Out of Control Emotions from Destroying Your Relationship. I give you Dr. Manning. Sherry?
Hi, everybody. Thank you, Jim, and thank you, Perry, for inviting me. It's fun to talk about this on a Sunday night, to think about talking about how we might help ourselves and people who love BPD, who have BPD, but it's also an honor because I've been a fan of NEABPD for a long time and really appreciate all the work that you all do. I'm going to talk tonight about dealing with unrelenting crisis and inhibited grieving, but as way of introducing that, I just want to tell you a little bit about my experience. I am a person who wanted to work with people who were suicidal most of my life. I think I started, the first time I said it out loud was when I was 16. And as I started studying suicide, I ended up kind of moving over into self-harm and suicide. And from there, when I was getting my master's degree, was teaching school and working with a suicide attempt cluster. And a professor of mine said, you know, you need to look into this thing called borderline personality disorder. And almost from the moment I first started reading about BPD, I knew it was kind of my life's calling for a lot of reasons, and a lot of it has to do with how amazing I think people with BPD are and how amazing the families are that love people with BPD. And so I kind of was looking for a treatment to do, and then in 93, Marcia Linehan was publishing her first articles on dialectical behavior therapy. And I studied with her. Interestingly enough, in 93, Perry Hoffman was there in the first big training outside of the University of Washington in DBT, and have done a lot of DBT in different contexts, always keeping my focus on treating BPD predominantly, and then training therapists of different kinds in dialectical behavior therapy. And last year, as Jim said, Helen Best, Cindy Bile, and I created the Treatment Implementation Collaborative, which is definitely a mouthful, but we were trying to explain what we're doing, which is really dedicated to implementing treatments as opposed to just training or consulting, but really getting them into systems and changing cultures and mental health practices in a way that will help the people who we treat. As all of this is going on, when I first started doing DBT, families were, I don't want to say left out of the treatment, but they weren't a big part of the treatment. I think some of that was the current climate of mental health in those days. There wasn't a lot of family treatment going on. Families were kind of left to the family therapists. And DBT really focused on treating individuals at the time. And I was talking to some people in Atlanta last week, and we were remarking on how that really is coming around. And there's now, in most mental health treatments, a sense that you have to treat the environment and the context that people live in if you're going to effectively treat them. And with BPD, you have to treat the people who are in the relationships with the people with BPD because their behaviors are so intense and can be so extreme and so frightening. And, you know, we spent a lot of time in DBT treating the therapists to keep them from burning out. And, you know, it's great that we have people like NEABPD now, systems like NEABPD, that say, hey, families burn out too. So I started putting all of this down in writing, and I started looking at the behavioral patterns that are in BPD behaviors. And Marcia Linehan, when she wrote DBT, had written all these targets and the, you know, kind of what other people might call the symptoms of BPD, the things, the behaviors that we see that often are very problematic, get people in treatment, and they meet the diagnostic criteria for BPD. But then she further broke it down into these things that we call the secondary targets or the secondary behaviors. And they're really kind of the behaviors that undergird those extreme crisis behaviors like suicide, self-harm, interpersonal chaos. There are often these kind of patterns that are behind there that keep those extreme behaviors repeating and repeating. And there are basically six of those. But I really wanted to talk about two tonight. And the reason I wanted to talk about these two is because, A, I haven't had an opportunity to talk about them at length, but also because I think that these are two that are really wreak havoc in family situations where people really can, they can get so that they're reacting to the behaviors as they come up. So, and this is kind of in my new thing. What I'm really kind of focusing on now in my thinking, in my writing, is these behavioral patterns and how we see them in the person with BPD, but then how we simultaneously start seeing them in the family as the family responds to the behaviors. So I'm going to just go through the handouts that I gave you, the slides. I apologize if y'all got them so late. I had been on vacation 2 weeks ago and wrote while I was on vacation, and then got home and 12 hours later went to Atlanta to teach, and took a different laptop, and I didn't have the slides on the laptop I had with me in Atlanta to send to y'all earlier. So if you don't have them and you want them, I know you can get them from the NEABPD website. So these two patterns, they're kind of extreme. So you can think of them as being poles, and they're unrelenting crisis behaviors. So these are kind of crisis-driving behaviors. And then the other extreme of that is inhibited grieving, which just in a phrase, I'll explain it more later, is just kind of stopping all emotion in very different ways. And I'm sure if you are on this call because you are in a relationship with someone with BPD, you've probably seen these things at time where the person is really emotional and making some really problematic decisions that are making things worse, that are making them more emotional, that are making things worse, that are making them more emotional. And then it's almost like they flip the switch and then they shut down all emotion, which, as we'll talk about, sometimes is relieving for the family but can also be problematic. So these two sets of behaviors are opposite poles of kind of the same behavioral pattern. And people can go back and forth between the two. And the family can follow. Either the person gets into extreme crisis and the family gets into crisis too, or the person can get into extreme crisis and the family will shut down, withdraw, or vice versa. So the first thing you got to do is recognize the behavioral patterns. Recognize the behavioral patterns in your person who has BPD, and then also in yourself and in the environment of the person with BPD. So let's start by talking about unrelenting crisis. I tried to put little phrases on what all these kind of mental health-like phrases are. And so unrelenting crisis is that everything's out of control. And it's not only that everything is out of control. Some of the things that are out of control aren't of the person with BPD's own making, but they're, you know, life events that happen that kind of spin things out of control. And then as the person's emotions go up, naturally, as all of ours do, in response to whatever that crisis is, then they engage in more behaviors that either perpetuate that same crisis or add other crises into the mix. So you end up with this cycle of crisis, impulsive action, crisis, impulsive action, and things can get very much out of control. Unrelenting crisis is basically what happens when you have a person who can't tolerate extreme emotion or stress or distress, and compounded with that, they have poor, inadequate problem-solving skills. So we all, as we go through our lives, have things that happen to us. And I think one of the things that can happen is we can get really judgmental of people with BPD. And we can say, you know, their problem skills are bad. You know, they bring all this on themselves. They cause all of their problems. But nobody causes all of their problems. And I see this, you know, where there's a sickness in the family. Or the person may lose their job to layoffs. Or, you know, someone gets ill. And so it's not that they started the crisis, but then the crisis happens, and then they can't tolerate it. So then they do something to make it, I'm putting better in air quotes, and now I'm just realizing y'all can't see me, to make themselves get some relief, and maybe that thing creates more crisis. But it can also be that in the beginning, something they engaged in trying to solve a problem in a way that was inadequate, and it started it. So I'll give you an example. I worked with a person who was in a relationship that had been fairly stable for a while, and it was a friend relationship. The friend had a grandson who was born with a heart problem. and he was in the hospital. He was very ill, and the friend wasn't available for my client as she had been previously. So the client started calling the friend repeatedly, wanting to know if the friend was angry at her. So she was distressed because she kind of lost her support. I think all of that in the beginning is a total reasonable thing. I mean, she didn't cause the problem with the friend, but then she started making it worse by overcalling. I think at one point she had called 50-something times in a span of, you know, from 9 in the morning to 12 in the afternoon, so like 3 hours. And the friend, of course, was already distressed about the grandson, and she became distressed. And she said, stop calling me. You may not call me again today. You can call tomorrow to check on my grandson, which is also a completely reasonable response. So she tells the client not to call her again. Now the client gets very distressed. Her feelings are hurt. She's worried that she has ruined this relationship, that she has called too much. So she gets in her car and goes to where this woman is. It ended up with a restraining order. The friend was distressed that she was there, said, I told you not to be here. You can't be here. The client got more distressed because she knew that this was problematic in the relationship, and so she started Facebooking other people, and by the time it was done, she had engaged in a series of behavior where she ended up having a restraining order against her and lost the friend. And if she had been able to tolerate in the very beginning, understanding that the friend needed the time away to take care of her grandson and to tolerate the fear that then she might have pushed the relationship, she wouldn't have engaged in a series of behavior that, had she been in a wiser spot, she would have never done. So she didn't know how to solve the problem of attending to the relationship with a friend, and she couldn't tolerate her own distress at not having contact with a friend. And so she got increasingly emotional, and as she got increasingly emotional, her behaviors got more and more and more extreme. So this is what unrelenting crisis is. There's the one kind of prompting event behavior, and then there's this kind of snowball effect, and that's the interaction between emotion and the ability to problem solve. And often this is where impulsive behavior comes in. Impulsive behavior functions often to relieve that distress, or it can be an impulsive problem solving. So I think I've said about how unrelenting crisis happens. I think sometimes you have to look at how problem solving gets in. Number one, we're not all born knowing how to problem solve. You know, there are entire treatments that have been written now that are the step-by-step problem solving. You know, I'd love to see us start teaching problem solving in schools. And I remember, like, when I was teaching in the late 80s, there was this kind of movement to teach some of this, but in all things that, you know, that are funding dependent, I think it just never happened. But people learn problem solving either because someone actually teaches them, says, listen, let's talk about how you solve a problem, or because problem solving is modeled in their environment. You know, I know some people who are really good problem solvers, and, you know, when they engage in that behavior out loud in front of their children stand a bit higher chance of knowing how to problem solve. But the problem is here is that a family member, a parent, can be a really great problem solver. And if they have this child who is very, very, very emotional, that high emotionality blocks their being able to experience the modeling. So it may be that if you're a parent, that you really have great problem-solving skills and that other people around you can pick them up and kind of run with them just from watching you and asking you questions. But if you had this extremely emotionally sensitive child, they may not have experienced them. So those problem-solving skills don't get in their repertoire of what to do when they're upset, there's something in their life that needs to be fixed. And then you have this high emotionality and an inability to control the emotions. So if your emotions are very, very, very high, I'm sure we all can think of a time when our emotions got really high, and your brain shuts down, then what a person with skills does is they do something to bring their emotions down. They might say, okay, I just got to walk away from this problem for a little bit. You know, I'm just going to go for a walk, literally, or I'm going to go do something else, or I'm going to go, you know, soothe myself. I'm going to do something so I can come back at it. And when you do that, your emotions come down. And then when your emotions come down, it's like your problem-solving ability opens up. And so then you can figure out, even if there's no solution to the problem except to tolerate it, you can figure out to do that. But people with BPD's emotions are always or often so extreme that they kind of run right past that problem-solving place in their emotional escalation, and they get to a place kind of automatically where their emotions are so high that they can't think to sit down and problem solve. If they're in DBT or other treatments, you know, I mean, that's one of the things we work really hard to do, is to teach people how to bring emotion down in the heat of the moment and how to problem solve. But it may well be that your person isn't in a treatment or doesn't have those skills. And so what do you do at that point? Well, you know, I'm a firm believer, of course, in treating this emotionality with professional help. And so this is a place I often find where you actually can get people with BPD in treatment, because that out-of-control emotional and problem-solving behavior is really a miserable place. They really don't want to get there. Unfortunately, sometimes the way we get them in treatment is kind of at the point of the crash that follows the unrelenting crisis behaviors, but sometimes when they're in the middle of it, it's a great place to move in and offer treatment if you're trying to get your person in treatment. When you can, coach the person on regulating emotion and using those skills that you have to tolerate distress. I've been amazed with my people how many times they have called me very, very upset about something at 10 o'clock at night. And I knew that, you know, given more emotionality and more time, they would end up engaging in a behavior that was going to be a problem. And when I've said, it's 10 o'clock at night, why don't you go to sleep? They often are like, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. So it's kind of a balance. It can be a little dicey in that, you know, you don't want them to think you're condescending to them. But often they'll take advice on how to regulate emotion. And if you can just say, you know, let's take a break from this. This problem is not going anywhere. It will be there tomorrow. It will be there in an hour. Why don't you do something to get away from it? Now, the problem is they have a very hard time reorienting attention. So you have to find something that's powerful enough for them that they actually can put their attention on it. We call that distracting. It could also be using your senses to soothe. There are a lot of things it could be. And I encourage people to create a list of those things when they're not emotional that they can have available when they are emotional that may work. After they get some distance, then have them engage in some problem solving with you, if at all possible. Sometimes it's just about saying, before you make this next move, think about the pros and cons of it. In DBT, we have this kind of multi-dimensional pros and cons we teach people. But if they're not in DBT and they don't know that, just say, let's look at the pros and cons. If you say, what do you think the wise thing to do here? It's amazing to me how many times a person can tell you, even when they're really, really distressed and haven't been in a skills training group, they can tell you what the wise or the smart, for lack of a better term, response would be. Sometimes it's about getting ourselves to do the wise response. But if you could just get a person to say, this is the wise thing, and then say, okay, so sit on that for an hour and see if that's worth doing. The key is, whenever possible, to get emotion down first so that then they can do problem-solving skills, either with you or on their own. I think it's helpful to have a list of how you problem solve, like what the skills are for problem solving, because when the people who we care about get really, really dysregulated, we have a tendency to get dysregulated with them. And so sometimes our problem solving skills go down too. So I just put this problem solving list on here just so we all could be clear on what it is we're talking about. The first thing to do with your loved one, if you can get them to sit down and soothe enough to open up their brain, is get a definition of the problem. And I think this is a place where we often, at least I often, kind of fall down the job. I assume, because I can see that a person's angry or hurt or full of shame, that I know what the problem is. And there's nothing that could be a trigger for more emotionality more than for someone to start solving a problem that's not your problem. Last week when I was in Atlanta, I had this, like, technology black hole happen where I was in a hotel that had been sold and it had no internet, so I couldn't get on my wireless from my computer. And something went down on my iPhone. I couldn't even send out an email to anybody. I saw Perry's emails coming to me. I couldn't get anything to go out. My husband is a computer man, so I figure, like, this is like a free help desk, right? So I call him to get him to help me. And before I could really tell him what the problem was, he was already giving me solutions. And, of course, he was giving me things I'd already tried. So what happened? My distress went up. I actually really wanted to hang up on the man. I didn't. But I was really distressed, and I was getting more and more distressed, and things were in my mind getting more and more catastrophic. And, I was having urges to do interpersonally ineffective things, like hang up on my husband. It was all because he wasn't taking the time to get from me a clear picture of the problem. And this happens a lot of times when we're dealing with some people with BPD, is we move into giving solutions to the problem without having a clear picture of what the problem is. So get a picture of the problem. Get a definition. Find out what they want. I wanted my iPhone to send out emails. Then brainstorm solutions. The key to brainstorming, when you look at the studies on problem solving, is for brainstormings to be kind of just almost like free association, where you're just throwing out any idea that could work, and you're not evaluating them in the moment, but that you just throw out ideas. And this is a great place to give your person something to be mindful of other than their distress. If you can get them throwing out ideas, you know, if you can throw out, you know, some that, you know, are realistic, and then a couple that are extreme but not dysfunctional, like, well, you could, you know, turn off your iPhone and have a week without iPhone, which would have been an extreme behavior in my book. Then a lot of times that will help settle emotion and get some more realistic solutions out. Then choose a solution. This requires evaluating solutions. Then troubleshoot them. This is a place that I think is really helpful for all of us, but really helpful if you get your person with BPD to this place, is to say, so what could interfere here? So what could stop you from being able to do this? So if I was problem solving with my client, how to tolerate distress and what to do until she could get with her friend, even when we had like a list of how to save the friendship, then to say, okay, so what could stop you? Like, what actually could make you pick up the phone and call her? Or what if you apologize to her and she responds negatively? So that you're kind of predicting what some of the problems are. If you don't do that and your person starts implementing a solution and it goes awry, then their emotion will get so high that the whole thing will shut down. Then implement the solution and come back and evaluate the effectiveness. Now, often when we have, especially when we have adult relationships, we don't walk the person through every step of this, but sometimes it's really helpful to do this. I think it's really important to remember some things when your person is on unrelenting crisis. And the first is that in this moment, she's doing the best she can. This comes straight out of the assumptions in DBT that we use with people. But it is that, you know, she's not trying to do things that are out of control. She's not deliberately wreaking havoc in her life. She's in the moment responding, and maybe responding in ineffective ways. But it's not with some ulterior motive, usually. If there were other solutions readily available, she would choose them. The person who taught me this was a woman who used to lie down in fire ant beds when she was distressed. And she would let them bite her all over her body, and she would go into anaphylactic shock, end up in the emergency room. And there were often these periods of unrelenting crisis. There was a lot going on in her life. She had physical problems, some of which were the direct results of all these fire ant episodes, some of which were not. She had extreme problem with her relationship with her parents and her sister, and she had difficulties at work and was about to not have a job that she really loved a lot. And there would be these episodes where something would happen with one of those things, like she would get a letter from the board where she worked saying, "We're thinking about cutting your program." It wasn't about her behavior. It was about funding. And then she would get distressed. And then she would call her family. And then she would say things to her family that caused them to react. And then she would get more distressed. And these things would build and build over time. And she would be lying down in fire ant beds. And I would be furious. And I had to learn from her that in those moments, that's all she could think to do. That part of what I had to do as a person who did not want to see her lying down in fire ant beds was help her to find other ways. But if she could have thought of anything else to do in that moment to tolerate the distress, to feel better, she would have done it. They're trying to relieve suffering when they're doing this. If you could just think about what it would be like to have your life out of control most of the time when... And everything you were doing seemed, as my client says to me, wrong. That her responses are wrong. That everything she does makes worse. Now, I don't think everything she does, but I think she's actually pretty close right now. And that at some moment in time, you're going to have to do something to relieve that suffering. Now, the thing is, though, is that all of these are true with family members. That in those moments, you're doing the best you can, and you're trying to help relieve her suffering and yours. And the only options you have available are the options you have in those moments, so that you take these things and you map them on top of each other. So that's unrelenting crisis. And, you know, this is a place where suicide attempts occur, self-injury occurs. And often when you get to, like, the really kind of near-lethal suicide attempt, it's like the ultimate end of that unrelenting crisis. It is, I have got to quit. I have got to stop. I cannot take any more of this. And then often they'll engage in a behavior that will relieve and go past relief and often go into shutting down emotion. We call this inhibited grieving. Inhibited grieving is really when the client says, or your loved one says, I don't feel anything anymore. That's not an untruth. It's often that they really have gotten to a place where they have shut down all of the emotion that they've been experiencing. And they can do this in lots of ways. They can engage in a suicide attempt or self-harm behavior. For many people, that is very effective at shutting down emotion. They can dissociate, if you know what dissociation is, where they literally, it's like they disconnect their current experiencing emotionally, their thoughts, their emotions, all things that are involved in their current experiencing, and they separate from that. And so people will say, I don't remember, you know, a period of time. I know I was there, but I don't really know what happened. But what they get during that time is relief from all of that emotion. I have several people who I work with now that this is what happens when they get in an unrelenting crisis and they're just, you know, cycling around in this emotion. Sooner or later, they'll just, like, shut down all their systems. They may sometimes, you know, go to bed for a few days or, you know, but sometimes, you know, I get a call from someone who's in a hotel room. This happened right over Christmas, in a hotel room 2 hours away, didn't know where their car keys were, weren't really clear what they had done over the last few hours. And she is not a drinker. She hadn't been drinking or using. But her emotions had just disconnected to that point. Her body was moving and she wasn't. What happens, though, is that learning occurs. So over time, as they shut down emotion when it's extreme, then they learn to shut down emotion. When I say learn, I don't mean like they sit around and go, oh, I'm having a lot of emotion, I'm going to do this and shut it down. What I mean is they kind of automatically happen. It's learning that makes it almost like a reflex. And over time, they get increasingly sensitive to cues, especially around sadness and shame. These are the two big emotions in inhibited grieving, which are about loss. And so loss kind of compounds with loss, kind of compounds with loss. And over time, whenever loss comes up, whether it's real, kind of in the moment loss, or whether it's a historical loss, a memory of a loss, or a memory about something that they feel shame about, they will automatically stop processing the loss and shut down. And then it's harder and harder and harder to recover from this without doing something extreme, which then flips them back into the unrelenting crisis mode. So you can see how these two things kind of rub up against each other. So inhibited grieving is overwhelming emotion, usually sadness, a lot of times shame, and then avoidance of that. So the minute, you know, emotions have physical sensations, and the minute those physical sensations come up, they just stop experiencing them. And you hear this when people say, oh, I don't do that emotion, or I can't do any more emotion, or if I have that emotion, it will kill me. Those are often the things that people say about inhibited grieving. So how do you know when a person's in inhibited grieving? Sometimes they'll just flat tell you, I stopped that. You know, they'll come into my office and I'll be like, you know, whoa, you were all distressed last week. What happened? They're like, yeah, I'm done with that. I just made it stop. I had to find out how they made it stop, of course. But more often than that, what you see is the antithesis of a lot of emotion on their face and on their body. So we all know, you know, how people look when they're really angry or they're really sad. But what will happen is these people will get like blank-faced. So you won't see a lot of emotional expression on their face. Their bodies will be kind of slowed down, but they won't have any of the normal emotional language, body language that they usually have. They'll say things that are unemotional. And you'll see them avoid cues for emotions. So if there are places where, or events that make them feel sad or make them feel shame or sometimes even make them feel angry or anxious, they'll start avoiding those things. So my client who was worried about her job, you know, every time she walked into her office, she got more anxious, so she just quit going to work, which, of course, then moves into some unrelenting crisis because then she's about to have her program shut down, but she's not there. She's showing them they don't need the program. I have on here the difference between apparent competence and inhibited grieving, just for those of y'all who know what apparent competence is. It's another one of these patterns. But basically, an apparent competence, the person with BPD says they have the emotion, but you don't see it. And in inhibited grieving, it is that the person literally is not having the emotion at all. What do you do? This is a really hard place. There are entire treatments that are written on how to get people not to shut emotion down the minute a cue comes forward. And they're very complicated, can be kind of risky treatments. So I put the most effective ones down on the bottom. It's called exposure therapy or exposure treatment. And, you know, that's the role kind of the professional who's moving in and assessing what they're avoiding and helping them to experience it. But when you see it, validate what you think the emotion is that your loved one would be experiencing. A clean way to do that is to say, if this was happening, I would feel X, Y, and Z. If this was happening, I would feel sad. Are you feeling sad? Validate how hard it is to experience emotion, especially when you've been really emotional for a little while. You know, it is hard to just let emotion happen without doing something to shut it down. Try not to set up situations that kind of force emotions to happen or not to happen. We can treat people with BPD like they're fragile, like they can't possibly experience emotion, like they will be overwhelmed. If they believe they'll be overwhelmed by emotion, and we believe it and reinforce it, then we're digging that hole deeper for them. Tied into that is generating hope that they can have an emotion, that they can survive it. And this is out loud generating hope. I know you can do this. We call this now, thanks to Alan Frusetti, cheerleading validation, or just moving in and saying, I know that you can do it. Another piece that I put in here is that when your person has been in unrelenting crisis for a while, and you've kind of been watching them hanging on by their toenails to, you know, what they have in their lives, which kind of makes you feel the same way. A lot of times when they go into this inhibited grieving place where they're not so emotional, where they're not engaging in these out-of-control problem-solving behaviors, we can feel a little relief. You know, it's like, and I think you have to accept that. It's not that you have to stay that way, but when you have that immediate response, like, oh, thank gosh. You know, I think this happens sometimes when people go in a psychiatric hospital, when they've been really distressed for a while, and then your loved one goes into the hospital, and there's just this moment of, I can breathe again, thank you. And to accept that and not judge that, this is really hard. You know, unrelenting crisis especially is a very scary place. You're kind of watching your loved one explode. And then when they implode and go down to inhibited grieving, it's very natural that you would have a moment of just being relieved. So as you do this, as you look at this, as you step back and observe and watch your loved one and see where these patterns play out in their lives, what you want to do is recognize that, excuse me, I had to tap a drink, that you have your own responses, and that it is very easy when your person with BPD is kind of having these out of control behaviors. Their emotions are very extreme. They're making decisions that we would never have them make. It's very easy in that moment to let go of our problem solving too, to get punitive, to react to their emotions emotionally, so that we can get an unrelenting crisis too. My theory is with psychotherapists for all these years that, you know, therapists have fired people with BPD. Oftentimes when I've talked to therapists and to clients, you know, in the moment, I had a client whose psychiatrist ran down two flights of stairs and out to the corner of the main street here in my town to tell a client never to come back. And I think that is largely about getting into crisis when the person with BPD gets into crisis. So our emotions go up with them. And then we say and do our own impulsive responses to their impulsive behaviors. So we say, don't come back, or get out of my house, or I don't want to talk to you. Or we move in and, you know, without really thinking through with wisdom what our responses are, we try to fix everything, which may be effective. I'm not saying it's not in that moment. But sometimes that's not adequate problem solving on our own part. So we can get there, or we can get to a place where they get more and more and more emotional and we just stop. We just turn it off. You know, I can see this in myself as I start to do this sometimes as a client when they've been, especially if they're upset with me or angry at me, and that's a part of kind of what's going on and it's in their unrelenting crisis, then I can just totally shut down and turn it off. And it's not a balanced emotional response. It's me just kind of disconnecting from the emotions that these people are making me feel. And family members can do this then too. And when they do that, then often the person with BPD sees that as withholding or invalidating, which then can make the crisis worse. So the first thing is to step back and look at the behaviors of your client or your loved one, and then look at your own behaviors and say, okay, now am I in the same place, or am I in a more middle place where I'm experiencing emotions, I'm regulating them in response to her or him, and I'm making problem solving, I'm making decisions about how to handle this from my own perspective in a wise way. I did pretty good. So I put this last slide in because this is my kind of my current personal favorite slide about working with people with BPD. And it's just kind of like the overall picture of what to do in the moment, independent of what pattern your loved one is having. And the first is, when your person is emotional, the more emotional they are, especially if you're watching the emotions increase, validate. Just validate. Validate as their emotions go up. The more you validate, the sooner they will come down. Keep validating until you see those emotions coming down. Then you can do other things. Validation doesn't solve the problems of the world, but it opens us up to having someone help us. It brings emotion down. So as you watch emotion go up, especially when they're in the beginning of unrelenting crisis, just validate. When you're emotional, when you're kind of following him or her up that path of emotionality, stop and regulate your own emotion. There's increasing research that one of the primary ways to regulate your own emotion is to know it's there, to see it, as we call it, observe it, notice the emotion, and then put a label to it. I am feeling X, Y, and Z. And automatically, when you start doing that, your emotion starts coming down. If you're feeling hopeless, get support. This can be a very lonely place to be when the person who you love and care about is kind of out of control or overly controlled. And, you know, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir when I say this because this is an EABPD. This is the place you want to be. Get involved. Get people in your life who can give you hope. When you're impatient, remember that change is slow and gradual, and celebrate, you know, those small steps of change in yourself and the person you love. When you're helping your loved one, don't treat her like she's fragile. Don't treat her like she can't tolerate anything in this world. And at the same time, don't withhold the help that you would give to anybody else. And I've seen a swing in both of these directions in our work with families over the years, where we were either saying, you know, get involved, do everything, you know, control all aspects of their life. And then we were saying, don't have a relationship with your people. There's a balance there, you know, and this goes into my last thing, which is if you don't know what you're doing, if you're not sure, if you're having doubts, you can never fail if you think, what is the humane thing to do here? Sometimes the humane thing is not to solve all the problems for your loved one. Sometimes the humane thing is to solve problems. Sometimes, you know, the humane thing is to let them experience their emotions. Sometimes the humane thing is to help them bring those emotions down. So if you're not sure, you know, there are all these rules and, you know, we now have all these really great things to say. But at the end of the day, step back and say, what's the compassionate, humane thing to do? My guess is you won't go wrong if you do that. I'm finished.
Wow. Well, you're a blessing, Sherry. Thanks for all these fantastic insights. I just got an email saying, how do you guys keep offering these great people? Sherry gives me so much hope for me and my son. Now, I do have a question or two.
Okay.
You ready? All right. Let's see. This is my daughter's psychiatrist doesn't think that my daughter has borderline, but she is positive for 8 of the 9 criteria. He says because her symptoms are not of severity that he often sees, he's hesitating to address her as true borderline. He says she only has borderline traits. Am I confused? Is this something that happens often, or is it better to start looking for another therapist?
Oh, that's a loaded question. You know, I think all things are true here. You know, there are a lot of times when people are looking at this criteria for BPD, they're looking at pervasiveness and severity as well as if it's just there. I mean, I think if you just look at a lot of the behaviors that make up BPD,
mm-hmm.
you know, so all of us can look that way periodically. And so one of the things they do is kind of look at, you know, the test of time and severity. I think that I would want to know how he's going to treat the traits. If he thinks they're traits, is he going to give her the same treatment that he would give someone who is diagnosed with BPD? And what is that treatment? And is it an effective treatment? So that's really what I would want to know. You know, we're all trying to destigmatize this disorder, and it kind of hurts my heart when I see people who are unwilling or unlikely to make a diagnosis out of stigma. But what I really want to know is the psychiatrist going to treat it, and are they going to treat it with something that's effective and can help?
Exactly, exactly. Okay, that's good. Now, another one here is my daughter acts like as long as we don't talk about things, there's no problem. How in the world do we get her to talk about the elephant in the room? Any suggestions to get her to open up? Pretty tough when you don't know her. But.
Yeah, that is pretty tough. And, you know, I think this can be a lot of things. And if I thought it was this inhibited grieving place, I would do a lot of what we call kind of normalizing validation or mind reading, where you basically say, you know, you take the pieces that you know are true, the facts. This is happening in your life. That must be really hard. You know, it would make me feel very sad or, you know, whatever, or very anxious or whatever the emotion would be that would kind of be the normal emotional response in that, and heap that up. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, there's that old joke about how many therapists does it take to change a light bulb? One, but the light bulb has to want to change. And I do think that you don't necessarily have to want to change, but you do have to, you know, if she's not on board on changing problems, that's the first place to start, is getting recognition of the problems. And a lot of times they avoid talking about problems for a lot of reasons. But one is that they think that they're inadequate for having the responses that they have, or pathological for having the responses they have. So I would start with a whole heap and help and a validation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Here's one. I'm 42-year-old, married mother of two, 9-year-old daughter, 6-year-old autistic son. I myself have BPD plus fibromyalgia, depression, and chronic fatigue. 20 years ago, I had an abortion at the suggestion of my future mother-in-law. Since then, I've had a lot of anger and inhibited grief about this event toward all involved, including myself. How would you suggest going about working on this? I'm in therapy using DBT, but it's not a full-time program, and I can't find a full-time program local to me. The event is still causing great pain to me and my family, which is already stressful with the autism.
That's a lot, and you've got a lot going on in your life, and there's a juggling, you know, here of the needs of a bunch of people. But the reality is the only way to get through the emotion about the abortion is to actually get through the emotion about the abortion. You have to find a way to experience that emotion. And, you know, it's for something like this where it's been with you for so long and you've been shutting it down for such a long time, you really would want this to be with a therapist. So it can be a part of your what we call stage one treatment in DBT, and if you can't get that there, to see if your therapist could get you an exposure therapist, someone who actually will sit down and figure out what the cues are for the emotion you're experiencing, like what the current cues are. You know, they're the past cues, the things that happened in the past, but what is it that's like bringing it up in the present so that you're then shutting it down? To help you experience that. Because, you know, I can make a lot of hypotheses about the anger piece, but my guess is that there's a lot of sadness in there about this. And that is the thing that you've got to be able to experience.
Right. Okay.
Can't find a therapist, email me. I'll see what I can do.
Okay. Do you want to give your email address?
Yeah, I think it's on the slide. Yeah, it's on the last slide.
We're covered. Okay.
Yep.
I think we can fit one more in here. Can you characterize the role of eating disorders in the context of other BPD behaviors? Is this a self-injury behavior?
Oh, if it is concurrent with BPD, it's not its own, you know, diagnosis without BPD. The way we're currently working on it is that we look at the function of the behavior. And even in a person with an eating disorder, that their behaviors can have different functions. So there are people who have, you know, restrict to control weight, but they also might restrict in a different way on a day that, you know, something is happening in their life and they're experiencing an emotion. So we use this thing called a chain analysis or which is a way of looking at behavior, and says, what are the variables around this behavior that are keeping this behavior going? When we're just classifying it as part of BPD, it usually goes into the self-harm behavior, but sometimes it's not of a level that's really self-harming, but it's more about regulating emotions. You know, a lot of people, when they restrict food, their emotion changes, or their sense of mastery and control over their environment changes. And so those are the pieces to look at, as opposed to just saying, well, it goes here or it fits there, to say, where does it go and where does it fit for you? Because it can be different from person to person.
Well, yeah. Okay. I got one that just came in. It's just a quick question, but probably to ask, but not may take longer to answer. But how do you handle constant suicidal talk?
That's exhausting. It is exhausting. And in my experience, you know, if a suicidal behavior and suicide talk doesn't exist in a vacuum, there are things that bring it on, and there are things that keep it going. So, I mean, I think from a managing the behavior in the person with BPD, what you want to do is, you know, get a professional to look at the behavior, and for you then to be looking at whether your behavior is maintaining it. How are you responding when they do this? Is there a way to change it? But then you really have to treat yourself. I mean, you know, this is like living your life standing on the ledge of a building waiting for the wind to blow, where you don't know if, you know, tomorrow will be the suicide attempt or the completed suicide. And the talk wears you down and out and can make you emotional. I have found that in treating people with BPD, the explaining of that in times when they're not in crisis, the effect, we use this thing that's called self-involving self-disclosure, where we basically say, this is where your behavior, how it affects me. We try to say it nicer. As my clients say, I'm always saying, Sherry, that hurts my heart, which is my way of saying it really does affect me. But I find that if you do it when they're dysregulated, it will not work to tell them how hard it is on you. But if you do it when they're more regulated, often they can hear it. And you got to be careful, because what you don't want to do is make them feel more guilty about it, but you want them to have a little bit of guilt so maybe they'll stop.
Mm-hmm. Could ask you questions forever, but I think we have to call it an evening, and you've been absolutely marvelous. Thank you so much for your time and your wonderful wisdom. And to everyone that's on the line, I must give you a reminder that next Saturday, that's the 5th of February, we're going to welcome back the return of Dr. Charlie Swenson, and he has in mind a new initiative that he's going to take with NEA BPD, and I know you're going to love it, but to find out about it, you've got to join us the next time around. So we'll see you in a week.
Thanks so much, Sherry. Thanks so much, Jim. And our call is next Sunday, the February 5th.
Thank you all very much. Have a good weekend.
Thanks so much.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now.